Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Open wide and say, ah, the Supreme Court's going to take up health care. The super committee, it turns out, really isn't. And a new series starting today on how we're going to feed the world. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday. It's the Marketplace podcast for the 14th of November. And if you want to know how serious the Supreme Court is about a given case, how big a deal it is, one good way to tell is how much time they allot for oral arguments. Your run-of-the-mill everyday case gets an hour, usually evenly divided. So when the Supreme Court announced this morning, just as everybody expected, that it is indeed going to take up the health care law, it was interesting to note that arguments will last 5.5 hours, an eternity in Supreme Court time. So all other things being equal, come summer we should have a ruling about what's called the individual mandate, whether the government can require Americans to have health insurance. But what do we do till then? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports on the costs of the waiting game.
A decision from the Supreme Court is expected around June, but the healthcare industry hasn't had the luxury to wait until then.
There's no alternative, really.
Bob Atlas is a health industry consultant with Avalir Health.
To gamble that the law will be overturned and then not be able to either be legally compliant or to meet the market opportunity would be foolish.
By market opportunity, he means the insurance exchanges. Those will be set up in 2014 in each state to sell insurance to millions of people who would be required to have it under the new law. Insurance companies can only qualify to sell insurance on these exchanges if they reform their policies, make the fine print more transparent, and stop disqualifying sick people. Insurers want to be ready.
They want to be in a competitive advantage when that time frame comes.
Chris Jennings was the senior healthcare advisor in the Clinton administration. He says it's not just insurance companies making those changes now.
That certainly applies to hospital providers and applies to many states.
But not all states. For political and budget reasons, some states have stayed on the sidelines. Deborah Cholet is a health economist at Mathematica in Princeton.
A number of states have lost time and funding for planning and probably will not be able to open an exchange.
And that makes it kind of tough for employers to plan for future health costs. Gene Marks is a consultant to small business owners.
They're looking ahead 2-3 years, and it really just adds that extra level of uncertainty now.
Legal uncertainty, and then even after that, there's that election to get ready for. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Speaking of uncertainty, there's a mere 9 days left until the super committee is supposed to come up with a deficit deal. $1.2 trillion in budget savings, as you've heard. If they pace themselves, that's just $133 billion a day they've got to come up with between now and Thanksgiving. But if you've perused the headlines today, you know there's new talk of maybe not getting it done, of delaying a deal on new taxes, leaving him until next year and a new Congress and possibly a new president that could possibly reverse scheduled automatic cuts even before they happen, which raises the distinct possibility we've all just been spinning our wheels. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
As the prospects for a super agreement grow dim, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, California Republican Howard McKeon, says a $600 billion reduction in defense is unacceptable.
To date, defense has contributed more than half of the deficit reduction measures we've taken, and there are some who want to use the military to pay for the rest, to protect the sacred cow that is entitlement spending.
And defenders of entitlement programs say cuts in food stamps and Medicare are equally unacceptable. With both sides hesitating, some lawmakers are considering an out. They know the mandated cuts don't take effect until January 2013, after the next election. Andy LaPerrier at ISI Group says at that point, Congress and the president could forego the trigger.
I think when we get to 2013, we'll be looking at taking another run at a big deficit reduction package.
President Obama warns he won't support any changes, but he may no longer be president when the cuts take effect. LaPerrier says not pulling the trigger means the whole super committee exercise is just lost time, with financial consequences.
At that point, the Moody's and S&P have said they'd downgrade the U.S. debt without a major fiscal consolidation package, and I think there's a very good chance that investors will lose faith in the U.S. if there's not a big package in 2013.
The lack of a genuine threat of automatic spending cuts saps much of the super committee's powers. The question is whether the credit rating agencies can offer committee members a lead box to keep the kryptonite contained. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today's organized labor update comes to you courtesy of the National Basketball Association. The Players Association has rejected the league's latest contract offer. They're going to disband the union and take the league to court on an antitrust claim. To do so, they've engaged counsel of some renown. David Boies is going to represent the players. He worked for Microsoft, you might remember, back in their antitrust days. On Wall Street today, just a hint of Euro nervousness. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Italian Prime Minister-designate Mario Monti said something promising and possibly troubling this weekend, depending on how you read it. Monti said he wants to build a, quote, future of dignity and hope for Italy's children, which could mean he thinks things are going to get better, or it could mean that they're going to get worse first, with more spending cuts and deep economic reform to build that future. Either way, families in Italy are starting to feel squeezed. From Rome, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Giovanna Di Maio seems to have it all. She's a lawyer, married to an engineer with two beautiful young children, and she works in the ancient heart of one of the most glorious cities in Europe.
Now we are in Palazzo Valentini, that is in the center of Rome near Piazza Venezia.
She works for the government in a Renaissance mansion with a stunning view over the city and its monuments.
That one is Colonna Traiana.
From her office window, she can see Trajan's column and many other relics of the Roman Empire. But sitting at her desk, Giovanna is focusing on her own immediate and not-so-glorious future.
My first concern is about my job, because in the process of austerity that the Italian government has in mind, they want to cancel my actual work.
The level of government that she works for is likely to be scrapped. At 42, Giovanna is getting a dose of American-style economic uncertainty, and it's painful.
In Italy, we are used to have the same job all life long. We know this will change, but it's not easy to change job when you are 40 or something like that. It's not easy to move like it's in America. We are not mentally used to move.
It's 8:15 and lessons are about to begin at the Istituto Massimiliano Massimo, a private school in a Roman suburb.
Buongiorno, buongiorno, bacio.
Giovanna and her husband Claudio are here.
Divertiti.
Ciao.
Dropping off their two children, 7-year-old Francesco and 4-year-old Elena.
Ciao amore, divertiti, buona giornata. Ciao, ci vediamo dopo basket.
Giovanna and Claudio say they send their children here because of sharply declining standards in the public schools, which they blame on spending cuts. School fees cost the couple around $15,000 a year. Claudio says they're feeling the pinch. The telecom equipment firm where he works has just had its government subsidy reduced, and he's had a 10% pay cut.
If we had not the parents, then we were really in trouble, especially in the long term.
But so your parents have been helping out?
Yes, exactly.
He says that as Italy's economic malaise deepened over the past year, many adult Italians did the same and turned to their parents for support, and many more will fall back on the older generation as further austerity measures bite. Claudio says, quite right too.
The old generation, they did the big debt that we have now in Italy. So they are somehow giving back this money, let's say this.
Italy's welfare state has been extraordinarily generous. The average retirement age here is still only 58. In some cases, it's been much younger. Giovanna says that some of Claudio's aunts retired in their late 40s, after only 19 years of work.
We knew that something that should have been done, because it was impossible to sustain such a system. It's only 19 years of work for about, 30 years of pension was not sustainable, and we knew this.
They both believe that there's a new mood of realism in Italy and that the new government of Mario Monti will succeed and wean the country away from its over-dependence on the state.
I think that we will work it out.
I hope so. I really hope so for my children.
But the fact that a privileged couple, a lawyer and an engineer, are so anxious about the future suggests that Italians could be facing a very tough time ahead. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I don't know that there's an official count of how long the Occupy protests have been going on, but today's day number 58 of the demonstrations that started in New York City. They've come to a close in Oakland, California, at least for now. Police moved in this morning to clear campers out of a plaza in downtown Oakland. The through line of this movement so far, at least the one that's been easiest to understand, is the wealth gap. We are the 99%, but the 1% gets to control everything story. So we decided to turn that on its head a little bit and ask a couple of people whether if the 1% had less, would the 99% be better off? First up, here's commentator Elspeth Gilmore.
I am the 1%. I recently marched on Wall Street with the 99%. I stand with the 99%, but I marched for myself, too. For decades, the U.S. economy has been organized to boost the wealth of the 1%. According to the Economic Policy Institute, 40% of all wealth gains between 1983 and 2009 went to the 1%. 82% went to the top 5%. All the rules of the economy have been tilted in my favor. Yet it is not in my interest to allow the disparities of wealth to keep growing. We should not have to hoard wealth in this society in order to keep our families healthy or to get an education. Health and a good education should be rights. My job at Resource Generation is to organize wealthy people under 35 who want to change this. There are more than 1,500 of us who know that our lives would be better if we personally had less, and we could all rely on a collective safety net. We need to reimagine what is possible. I want to live in a world where we together provide the basic needs of all people. Adequate infrastructure and roads, well-funded school systems, clean water systems, innovative transportation, and healthcare for all. We need a more just economy. And one of the ways to get there is for people like me to pay higher taxes. Let's change the policies that keep the wealth in the hands of a few. Let's increase millionaire taxes and end loopholes for corporations. Please, tax the income from my investments at least as much as my earned income. It's common sense. So let me say this as plainly as I can. Tax me. Tax the 1%. If the 1% had less money, we, 100% of us, would be better off.
Elspeth Gilmore is the co-director of Resource Generation. Tomorrow, Rehan Salam on the same question. If the 1% had less, would the rest be better off? Send us your thoughts about that or whatever else you hear on the broadcast. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, how are we going to get enough food for 9 billion people?
In Africa, under the best conditions, you can get 10 times more yield than what farmers get today.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so even with new management in Italy, Wall Street is still nervous about Europe. The Dow Industrials dropped 0.6% today, 74 points closed at 12,078. The Nasdaq forfeited 0.8%, 21 points, finished at 26.57. The S&P 500 lost nearly 1%, 12 points, ended at 12.51. Uncertainty knocked financial stocks. Citigroup slid 3.25%. Morgan Stanley unloaded 2.75% today. Markets might have been worse, but for a couple of winners, Boeing added 1.5% after winning a $26 billion order from Emirates Airlines. Lowe's built up 1.75% after reporting better-than-expected quarterly profits. Home Depot reports tomorrow its shares nailed a 0.5% gain today. Japan's Nikkei Index was up more than 1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.05%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports monthly retail sales data for October. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for October. And a Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Subcommittee discusses financial security issues facing older Americans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are now, the United Nations tells us, 7 billion people on this planet. Sooner rather than later, another 30, maybe 35 years or so, there's going to be more than 9 billion people. It's a whole lot of mouths to feed. So today we're starting a year-long series about the global food system and how we're going to feed those 9 billion people if we're going to be able to feed them at all. We start by way of illustration at dinner. You can kind of think of the world's food system as a giant potluck dinner.
Hello, come in.
Come in.
The first thing that strikes you is the abundance. There's a huge table. It's piled with food. And the smells.
Magnifico.
Wow, what is that?
It's a goat stew. Try some.
50 years ago, people were eating a lot less, on average, especially meat.
They have a hamburger. It's delicious.
Back in the 60s and 70s, about a billion people, one in every three human beings, were hungry. Millions of people were dying in famines in China and Africa and Bangladesh. People worried there was no way to keep up with an exploding population. But then came the Green Revolution, and over the course of just a couple of decades, global food production skyrocketed. Famines are now actually pretty rare. We're producing more food, and we're better at dealing with emergencies. But even with that, things aren't exactly working. Down at this end of the room, there's a family sitting on the floor with a few grains of something. It looks like millet. The number of chronically hungry people in the world is still around a billion. Granted, that's 1 in 7 of us, not 1 in 3. But still, it's a lot. And clearly, something's out of whack, because there are also about a billion obese people worldwide. Actually, a lot of things are out of whack. Back here in the kitchen, the water system's all messed up. There's too much in some places, not enough in others. There's a big pile of rotting something over there, and man, it's getting hot. And crowded, too. There's hardly any room to move. Here comes another busload of people. They look hungry, too. And so a question you might draw from such a scene setter is, now what are we supposed to do? More than 9 billion people. So over the course of the next year, in collaboration with Homelands Productions and PBS NewsHour, we're going to be looking at what we have to do now to be able to feed ourselves in the future. And maybe one place to start is science. Can't we just research and develop our way out of this? Because it's worked before. Here's John Miller.
I figured Mexico was a good place to go to take a look into the scientific pipeline. This is where farmers thousands of years ago transformed a grass called teosinte into what we now know as corn. It's also where scientists in the 1950s and 60s developed the semi-dwarf wheat varieties that launched the Green Revolution. My first stop is where a lot of that work was done, at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center outside Mexico City. I'm here watching technicians clean and sort experimental corn seeds to go out around the world. I ask research director Marian Banziger if there's some big game changer on the horizon. She says, basically, forget about it.
It is not just one solution. I mean, our action plans are 10 approaches, and the 10 approaches are not just breeding. They are about really looking at the whole livelihood of a farm family.
So the idea isn't just to increase the total amount of food the world produces, it's also to make life better for the 2 billion or so people who depend on farming for their food and livelihood. Because ironically, most of the world's poorest and hungriest people are in the food production business. If they can produce more, the thinking goes, everybody benefits. Banziger says for most crops, a good place to start is by closing what's known as the yield gap. That's the difference between what farmers could be producing using existing technology and what they actually do produce.
In Africa, under the best conditions, you can get 10 times more yield than what farmers get today. On average, I would say in Africa, we can increase production 4 or 5 times.
In Asia and Latin America, she figures output could double. Actually, realizing those gains, well, that's the challenge. I go on a little field trip to see Porfirio Bastida, who farms just over an acre of corn near the Mexico City airport. The city's been creeping closer and closer, sucking up water and land. For the last 3 years, Bastida's been practicing what's known as conservation agriculture. He doesn't plow and he doesn't hoe, and he lets the stalks and leaves of the corn plants stay in the field after harvest. American farmers have been doing this for decades to control erosion, but here it's a pretty radical departure from the way people normally farm.
Mire, en primer lugar, hemos visto que pues ya no tenemos suficiente agua.
Yeah, so basically, Porfirio is saying that they decided to use conservation agriculture because they don't have much water available for their crops. When they keep all the organic material on the soil, that helps the field to retain humidity.
Bastida says he's using much less water now, and he's harvesting twice as much corn. Plus, it's less work. Still, of all the farmers in this area, so far only he and his wife have adopted the method. Take-home message? It takes time for new things to catch on. I spend the next day tromping around cornfields with Fernando Castillo, a Mexican geneticist who teaches at a nearby university. Working with a tiny budget, he helps local farmers improve the way they select the corn they'll save for planting the next season. These are traditional varieties, not hybrids or GMOs, and since Mexico is where corn comes from, there's lots of genetic diversity in any given field. Castillo says with a little tutoring, Mexico's 2.8 million corn farmers can accomplish much more than a few plant breeders with PhDs.
Farmers have worked for years, and they have learned from their parents and grandparents the local conditions and the management. So most of it is based on local knowledge and local resources.
Castillo says the process could raise Mexican corn yields by 2% per year, which is just about what's needed to keep up with the demand. But he's been at this for 15 years, and he's still just working with a handful of farmers. Around the world, thousands of scientists are hacking away at thousands of problems. Some are experimenting with agroecological methods, mixing different crops and trees and animals to diversify diets and reduce the need for chemical fertilizers. Others are trying to breed crops that resist insects or diseases, or that tolerate flooding or drought. Some of this stuff is pretty ambitious.
This field contains the first experiment of the Wheat Yield Consortium in Mexico.
Matthew Reynolds is a wheat specialist at the Maize and Wheat Center. He's heading a global push to make wheat plants much more efficient at converting sunlight into grain. There's a parallel effort going on in rice.
This is actually a very interesting area, the spike photosynthesis, because no one has ever systematically tried to improve this photosynthesis of the spikes.
It's not just about the spikes. Those are the parts of the plants with the seeds on them. It's about fundamentally changing the way the plant works. Reynolds says the research will take 20 or 30 years to bear fruit, if it bears fruit at all. But it could increase wheat yields by 50%.
So what are the odds? The answer to that question is more, what are the consequences if we fail?
But no one is really counting on the project succeeding. There are just too many scientific uncertainties. So the strategy for now is to keep working on as many fronts as possible. With climate change and another 2 or 3 billion people coming, I ask Marianne Banziger if it'll be enough.
We can feed the world in 2050. Maize is the livelihood for 900 million poor people. Wheat feeds more than 1.2 billion poor people. Yeah. So it is a little bit absurd to think that the resources are not there. They are there.
Still, everyone I talk to here says no matter how generous the funding, no matter how good the science, it won't make a difference if government policies aren't right. That means fair prices for farmers and help when crops fail. It means access to land and roads and warehouses and markets. It means education and nutrition programs and family planning. But you can't just wait for all those things and then call in the scientists, because if there's one resource scientists need more than anything, it's time. In Texcoco, Mexico, I'm John Miller for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, tourism is a big economic deal in this country, you know, many billions of dollars worth of big economic deals. So a new marketing campaign from a public-private partnership called the Corporation for Travel Promotion caught our eye the other day. America, I'm quoting here, as the United States of awesome possibilities, which, yeah, just begs for other ideas.
I mean, it's a little overboard, the awesome, you know.
The United States of limitless opportunities.
We welcome anyone that wants to come visit. We certainly welcome anyone that wants to come buy our stuff.
United States of acceptance.
I would say United States, y'all come, but that seems to be just a little more colloquial than perhaps a global advertising campaign.
Somebody's getting paid good money to come up with something better than awesome. Am I wrong? I'm not wrong in that.
No, not wrong. Brandon Flood of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Ron McMillan of Richmond, California, Don Stewart in Homewood, Alabama, and Dennis Meacham and Karen French of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. If you've got a better idea, and please tell us you do, send them along. Our website's marketplace.org. The link you need is the one that says contact. All right, that's it. That's all we got. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow dropped 74 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ forfeited 21 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 lost 12 points, nearly 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow for the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, the fallacy behind a lot of famines.
In very few places do people starve to death simply because there's a drought.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, continues. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.